I'm super excited to have you back. We were able to sit down and chat a while ago, but due to some unforeseen circumstances, that episode didn't come out. So I'm excited to have you back. So with that being said, one of my only canned questions, I guess I have two, but we'll get to the second one later. And the first one is how did you end up in vet med? Were you one of those people that, like, as a kid, you knew you wanted to be a doctor? Or how did you lead down this path into veterinary medicine?
So as a kid, I knew I loved animals, like so many of us do. I found myself preferring the company of the dogs and the cats and the rabbits, eventually got a horse. We had a few lizards here and there, but did not think vet med would be my career. I really had no idea. And when I was in high school, I started to spend more time with horses in particular. I've always been a horse girl, as I know so many are, and just absolutely loved working at a local barn. Actually did part of my senior classwork as a senior high schooler at a local farm and just riding horses and mucking stalls and doing all that fun stuff. And decided to go to Michigan State University for a horse management program to learn how to run farms and to manage ranches. And enjoyed it a lot, but something was still missing. I ended up going off to Glacier National Park in Montana for a summer while I was, you know, kind of as an externship through Michigan State. And I was like, okay, I'm starting to spread my wings a little bit. I really like that independence, getting out there in the world and meeting new people. And so horses were still a part of my life, but I thought maybe not necessarily to run a ranch. Long story short is I ended up, after that horse management program, going down to Tennessee to work at a pleasure riding training farm, basically, and really enjoyed working with a veterinarian there on site. This was in a little town of Philadelphia, Tennessee, and loved working with that vet. Loved to see his flexibility in the day. He could just go off, see these wonderful horses, sometimes work on the dogs and cats too, get a chance to talk and share stories with the families. I thought maybe this is something that I can do. So when I decided to start the path towards vet med, I thought I was going to be a horse doctor. Right. Again, always being a horse girl, loving horses in general. But then in vet school, discovered that I didn't like horse medicine and thought, well, what's my second love? Dogs and small animals. So ended up focusing on small animals in general. Certainly, Clint had no idea that eventually it would move me towards end of life specialty work. That was nowhere on the radar.
Okay. So there's a couple of things you said there that I think are unique, really interesting. A, you said that you went up to Glacier National Park and you had kind of felt this love for meeting and interacting with new people. And then later on, you're telling your story about working with this horse veterinarian. And then again, you kind of reemphasized, you know, you heard this veterinarian talking and sharing stories with like the families that this doctor worked with. And I think what's interesting, especially in COVID, I think brought to light so many veterinarians like love curbside, right? Because it takes the pet parent out of the exam room and they kind of just get to work on the patient, right? But you seem to have this different approach where you like the human interaction side. Am I correct in that? Or is there something different? Or do you actually really enjoy the people side of vet med as well?
No, you hit the nail on the head. I am a story gal through and through. I'm one of those veterinarians that could just sink into an appointment and do nothing but listen to stories, right? How did the dog get its name? And what are the favorite foods of the cat? And where they like to sleep at night? Some of that stuff may seem rather mundane, but that gives me so much good information, not only about the human-animal bond and that relationship, but just how does this animal really engage with its environment? And what are those enrichment details that help me to understand its quality of life? So I do. I absolutely love stories. And you're right. It's shaped my entire career.
So how did you, I mean, did you just have a knack for this, like the people side of things and like hearing people's stories? So was it just like, did it come more natural to you? Or is it something that you had to work at? So, you know, like after you graduate, when you get into that exam room as a new doctor, what was that first like client doctor relationship like?
I'm going to take you back to a time when I was in vet school and actually went back up to Montana to work with a cattle rancher, veterinarian combination role. And I remember riding in the car with this veterinarian's two sons that were right around the middle school age. And we managed a conversation for, I swear, 45 minutes. And after that car ride was done, she says, "You know what? I don't think I've ever met somebody that can talk to just about anybody the way that you do. Because here I am that should have nothing in common with these two middle school boys, but we could carry on that conversation for forever." So more than likely, it's just inherent in me. I'm one of those people that like to relate. I like to listen first and then talk. So if roles were reversed here, I'd be the one doing the podcast with you and taking in all your backstory, right? Yeah. So I've learned how to leverage that. I found myself doing really good in waitressing and bartending jobs because everybody likes to tell their story and I like to listen. But how I pull that then into vet med even further is when it comes time to listen to the history of the pet and to understand, again, that human-animal bond and the relationship in that first interaction, best thing I can do is just sit back and absorb, right? Throw out some good open-ended questions such as, how did she come to be in your life? And what kind of changes have you been seeing? Those things, and just give them a chance to unload. Give me as much information as I can. And then I can go ahead and shape, of course, the further questions from there. That's just good history taking 101. I was talking to a colleague of mine about the power of open-ended questions and in giving your clients the chance to explore, you know, their goals and their concerns and certainly share what they've been seeing. And we talked about, wouldn't it be interesting if actually in communication, you could get everything you needed for the pet owner's history and background, as well as your patient, just by well-placed empathy statements, such as, "Oh, that must be really hard. You know, that's really hard to watch." And then what that does is build trust and establishes rapport with the client. And then they're able to unload more, right? Give more detail. And so those properly placed empathy statements make a big impact. So again, getting back to this idea that, yep, always been good talking with people in general and like to hear those stories. And I do try to work that into my interactions with clients as much as I can.
Oh, so many questions there, but I would like to kind of then transition in your own personal story. So you realize you don't want to work on horses. I would love to know your thoughts there. Like, what was it all of a sudden about large animal? Was it large animal in general, or is it just horses specifically where you didn't like the medicine side of it there?
Yeah. So I didn't have a whole lot of livestock education in vet school. I didn't track that way. I started with equine and the horses. And I think what I found is that the medicine was more challenging than I realized, and probably more true to the point is that I didn't enjoy some of the mystery being taken away from horses, right? They're rather magical creatures to a little girl like myself growing up and just their mystique. And then now here I am talking about all their pathology and conditions. And a lot of times they ended in euthanasia, which again is a little bit juxtaposition with the fact that now I'm AKA Dr. Death and everything that I focus with end of life work. But I didn't like the fact that much of the time we didn't get to practice the medicine because euthanasia was going to be chosen. It was too expensive or it wasn't in the horse's best interest. So that's probably what moved me away from it. And I just had to have a reality check with myself that says, I love horses. I can continue to advocate for them and learn what I can now in my animal welfare work to help to protect their welfare and well-being, but not necessarily practice medicine for them.
Any horses now?
Darn it. No. In fact, when I left Glacier National Park, after having taken people on horseback rides for what ended up being 2 summers, I loved it so much. My first summer, I went back a second summer. And I thought I would never pay to ride a horse. Like, who does that? And now here I am with no horses, being lucky enough to ride horses of friends and family from time to time. But otherwise, I go up to the mountains in Rocky Mountain National Park and ride horses up there.
Okay. So then you said that the next thing you know, I like dogs. So how do you transition from initially, well, we learned about the horse side of things and kind of losing the mystique there. But then, yeah, how do you get into the specialty of end of life? And I'll say, like, you're amazing at what you do. I mean, you answered the call when, you know, our dog had a brain tumor and I was an absolute wreck and I can't thank you enough. Like, it seriously takes a special person to handle that. And like every time I'm in a hospital and I'm you know, we're talking technology, so I'm not really thinking about the medicine. And then you see that family walk in and they're carrying their dog and the tears are coming down. I'm like, I'm a wreck, right? Like, I'm like, oh, I don't know how you guys do it. It's like the toughest part of vet med. Like, now having worked in vet med, like, I don't think I could be a doctor because I don't think I could handle the stress of that. So how did you transition into that?
In veterinary school, I knew right from the beginning that I was going to be a life learner. Like every single specialty that I was placed in particular fourth year, I loved. So after a week in dermatology, I wanted to be a dermatologist. After 2 weeks in oncology, I wanted to specialize in cancer, right? So I was like, oh, wonderful. I'm just taking it all in. And so really at the end of my schooling, it became clear that probably just approaching things in general practice was my best direction, where I could have a little bit of oncology work and surgery and dermatology and internal medicine, just roll it all into GP. That's how I kicked off. And I graduated Colorado State in 2004 and ended up doing private practice in Michigan for a couple of years, as that's actually where I grew up, was in the west side of Michigan. So 2 years in general practice there, had great mentorship, wonderful hospital. It was the Animal Medical Center of Wyoming, Michigan, the town of Wyoming, Michigan, and just really good experience. And there was one patient in particular that I had been treating for lymphoma, larger dog, kind of a hound lab mix. And he ended up coming into the hospital on emergency. I was the only one that was on call. He came in and we had a rather, what I'm going to call traumatic euthanasia in the lobby floor, right? Basically got him in the door. I had my euthanasia solution there. He could barely breathe. And we made the decision to euthanize him without even getting him into a comfort room, just move forward for his comfort. And I thought, boy, there's got to be something better we can do for dogs like this. And so I asked my employer at the time, could we start doing some home euthanasia? Would that be possible? And this was back around 2005, probably. And so we figured out a way to do some home euthanasia services. And that's really where the experience started to click for me. I thought, this is special. Not only do we keep these animals in the comfort of home where we know they want to be, it gives our pet owners, our clients, an opportunity to shape that environment in a way that resonates with them, kind of pseudo ceremonies or pseudo funerals, and gives me a chance to get out of the hospital, which I liked. I like that flexibility, and to then immerse myself in their environment, which is rich with stories. So it really was checking all these boxes that made a lot of sense. And so I started doing a few of those in Michigan, but always knew that I was going to be returning back to Colorado, and thought to myself, well, I'm going to go back to Colorado and in and around Fort Collins, where Colorado State is, and the vet school is there, but also there is a vet hospital on every corner. What can I do that's different? What can I do that's really going to make a difference for this community? So I thought maybe I could provide in-home euthanasia 24/7. And 24/7 is probably the most important part of that statement, because there was already a lot of mobile vets in Northern Colorado, but not that were 24/7 and not focusing in on euthanasia. So is true to me, I made the decision, came up with a company name, went back, got myself all set up with the business in the state, and was off and running. From there, though, Clint, I was providing home euthanasia for better part of 2 years, solo, by myself, 24/7, raising a family. And something was starting to just kind of gnaw at me, starting to bother me a little bit. And people were asking, well, are you burning out on the death? Is that getting hard? Because a lot of people thought I was crazy for doing this. First of all, this was relatively new back at that time. And I thought, no, something's bugging me. And what it was the level of suffering that I was seeing these animals in by the time that I got to the home for euthanasia, right? Wherein I would pronounce the pet deceased and the family would say, oh, thank goodness that's over. Right? That's been so hard. This has been so hard to watch them go through this and being in pain and not being able to get around and just being stressed and all that. And I'm thinking, well, you know, why didn't we have more care between that terminal diagnosis and death? So that's how I branched into and grew into animal hospice and grew my company from there. And then eventually about 5 years in, no, probably even longer, maybe 6 or 7 years into that service, in Colorado, I also branched into aftercare. So I started a water-based crematory. So I was a full service end-of-life provider. So long story short, moving from academia in my schooling, just saying, let's just start with general practice. Let's put everything out there. I can dip my toes into all types of medicine, and found myself naturally gravitating towards those end-of-life experiences and the importance of those, that compassionate time with our pet owners.
Yeah. So I would love you, have you, I guess, since you like stories, you know, like when I had talked to you, last time with our, you know, a dog that had a brain tumor, we had actually the hospital we had gone to, he ended up spending like 48 hours there, and they were amazing. Like the neurologist was amazing. And actually we took them to see Dr. Spiligoy. I'm not sure if you know her. She's an oncologist. She, for our other dog that had, that came down with TCC, like amazing, amazing place. It's Wheat Ridge Animal Hospital. They did an amazing job on all those fronts, but I'm not going to lie. The end of life portion of it was pretty subpar, especially like when everything else that they had done for us just seems so top notch. And I guess, you know, you talked about this kind of like in better end of life thing. And so I kind of have two questions. One, have you heard of Youth Bag?
Oh, yes.
Or is it Youth A Bag or Youth Bag? I think.
Youth A Bag.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Celine. Is it Celine? I think is it
Celine.
Celine. Yeah. She's the French Canadian name. And I butcher it every time. But A, I think about like what she talked about, you know, this idea of like, you know, it's like then, you know, like pet parents sometimes see their dog basically get thrown into a plastic bag. And so then there's this whole, and that's kind of the way we felt. Like they came in, he was paralyzed from the neck down. We knew that like there was nothing we could do. And so, and honestly, I think he might have passed like just with the sedation, because it was kind of like there was really nothing, like the life was seemed kind of be out of him. But they're like, okay, cool. And then whenever you're ready to leave, just put him on the couch. And I was like, that's, I don't know, that just seems weird. You know, it was like, here's an animal that had been part of my life for 16 years. Basically my kid, you know, like first dog that my wife and I really had together. And now I'm just going to like leave him on the couch, you know? So it was like, and it was weird. Like even maybe it's weird, but you know, like we cover him up with the blanket and we're like, it just seemed really weird. Like we just kind of want like, yeah. And so that whole piece kind of seemed a bit disappointing. And I think we had, and I was even like, we are going to do the at-home euthanasia side. Like I was like, you know, when things started going downhill, but he was so unstable that they're like, well, we have to know when you're going to leave so that we can arrange it at the exact same time, because it's just, he's too unstable. So I was like, well, there's no point in putting him through more. We might as well just do it at the hospital, which is another piece of it. But it's, I mean, how many, so I guess where I'm going with this is, you know, now that you have kind of become, you've become a thought leader in this space, how many hospitals do you see where it's like everything else is really top notch, but then they just don't, like things just don't seem to click on the end of life side?
Well, I want to start by saying thank you for sharing your story, and your listeners will have that feeling that you were left wanting, right? You were wanting more. You wanted to honor your dog more, and that it stays with you, right? This experience stays with you. That's one of the things that we try to impart upon the hospitals and the staff that we teach, is you can do everything amazing throughout, you know, womb to tomb, cradle to grave, birth to earth, all the way through. But if we drop the ball in those final moments, that is likely what will be remembered. And that is why we talk about how often we get thank you cards, right? For a good euthanasia and a good end of life experience, because families are so grateful. But it is, as much as we know that the end of life experience is important, we don't necessarily, as a profession, as an industry, give it its due time in education and building our own awareness of everything that's available, all the different approaches that we can take as a profession to not only care for the dying animal, but to care for its owner. And in fact, in animal hospice as a whole, we talk about the entire patient is the animal and the owner, right? That's our combined patient. So we have to meet the needs of both. And one of the things that we try to advocate for is more pre-planning. which I know is difficult to do in an emergency situation where we think we have to do everything just bing, bang, boom right away without a lot of room to breathe and process and think about what's happening. But even when it comes to the aftercare, like your experience, Clint, that you could have, for example, had the opportunity to take your dog home with you if you wanted to, right? And let your other dogs see, and just to spend time, that it doesn't have to be an all or nothing right now, no other choice. Or where you could lovingly tuck him into a little basket, right? Or even caskets. Some hospitals have caskets that you can tuck them all in with the blankets, and that's your final departing memory. Euthabag, and Dr. Céline Lehartou is her full name.
Yeah, exactly. And, awesome.
And you can, you know, like she often talks about with those euthabags is having those all decorated up with sayings and tribute words and things like that, that add that special touch, especially for those families who will be taking their pet home to let them lie in state for a bit, or will be taking them to the crematory themselves, or of course doing a home burial. So I think it's more for our profession to start to apply time and resources to learn about how to honor and pay tribute to the animals, not only, of course, after they've passed with your type of experience, but beforehand. So opening up that conversation with owners about what are their goals? You know, what are their goals? How do they expect or desire for their animal to die, to have its final moments? And that might seem kind of radical, but to actually say, how do you envision, you know, your cat's passing? And we did a little bit of a kind of market research with my old company, and 95% of our families would prefer natural death, but were open to euthanasia. And then of those 5% that were, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. 95% wanted natural death, but were open to euthanasia. 95% of those 95 chose euthanasia, but at least we gave them a choice, right? And if they say, I absolutely don't want to euthanize, then we need to step up our medicine and handle all those comorbidities and different disease states that are going to come from the dying process and reduce that suffering, right? Reduce that pain, reduce anxiety and other things that might occur. So we are challenged to do really good medicine, which is part of the reason we often default into euthanasia. It's more clear cut. It's a guarantee to end suffering sooner than later, but it's not right for every family. But the more that we can start talking about this pre-planning, that's the kind of stuff that can be in handouts. It can be online. There can be more tele-advice conversations, more quality of life assessments that are all of great use to pet owners.
So how did you, you know, because you have such a wealth of knowledge in this space. So how did you become, you know, because like I love to educate and I love to be out, and I have so many doctors, like, I don't know how you do it. Like I couldn't get up in front of a room, and, you know, but you went from like, you have this story of wanting to work on large animal, that changes. You find this euthanasia pathway, you start this new kind of series of businesses all around end of life. So then how did you get into now taking that a step further and becoming an educator in end of life process?
Very organic, that's for sure. Although I've probably always been a teacher to some extent. Probably what really kicked it off was the first couple of years of my mobile euthanasia service before I got into hospice as well. I had created an online directory called inhomepeteuthanasia.com. And the reason I did that is because a lot of veterinarians, let me back up, a lot of pet owners were finding me online, probably because I had bad CEO. I had people calling me from Texas and from Connecticut, right? And I'm in Colorado. Yeah. They're like, oh, do you service us? I'm like, I better fix my SEO.
Yeah.
And anyway, figured out that there were starting to be other services that were developing, so I could start to refer to them around the country. But I was forming a network. I didn't even realize it, but basically forming a network of colleagues that really were passionate about this space too. And they started asking me a lot of detailed questions about how did I get started and how did I grow as fast as I did? And when am I going to be hiring on new vets? And, you know, just what were the protocols that were making an impact in my community for my patients? So I wrote a book. I wrote a book on in-home pet euthanasia that I ended up publishing through Amazon. And that's probably what kicked it all off, because shortly after that, I was helping the AVMA with their euthanasia guidelines. I was starting to teach in the veterinary school there at Colorado State, started to write other articles, and it just snowballed from there until really around 2016 is when a little seed was planted in me by a colleague, Susan Gregerson out of England. And she said, you know what, Kathy, what you should do in your next chapter is create a euthanasia training academy. And so that's how the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy got started. And our purpose is to provide outstanding education in companion animal euthanasia to improve the overall experience for the pet, for the owner, and for the veterinary team, right? Because we're all shareholders in that experience. And so we created a master program and then webinars, and we do research, but we teach those professionals who have been out in practice for many years, right? Even those who have been seasoned for 20 years or more, they can always learn new tips and tricks. A lot of veterinarians have come to me over the years and say that I could just never crack that nut, figure out a solution to that problem. And thanks for teaching me a new way. And then we also teach at the veterinary schools. So we are in core curriculum in a couple of them, and then elective curriculum in others. So getting that education to the veterinary students before they graduate, so they're day one ready, and then as well in private practice. And then, Clint, I also am Chief Medical Officer of Caring Pathways, as I believe you know. And yep. So Caring Pathways, what they're now kind of leveraging my background and my experiences to help them, for example, build out their euthanasia protocols better and better, and build out their hospice protocols and policies, and really shape that medicine to support the patient to our best ability. And that is in their Colorado location, their Virginia location, and soon to be North Carolina.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job there, because a friend of mine just went through it. I didn't normally, like most of my friends now that they work in vet med, like sometimes they come to me first, who should I call? Who should I talk to? Right. And I'm like, I'm not a vet. I hope you realize this, but I can point to some bright people. So actually I was surprised, like, cause they had called me and asked me for some other vets and, you know, like a good cardiologist and stuff. And then they're like, yeah. And then we were sitting down and we were talking about Emma and, you know, them losing her. And then they mentioned Caring Pathways and they're like, it was amazing. They're like, it was the best experience. Like when we get another dog, that's the only way we're going to ever do it again. And I was like, oh, that's amazing to hear. And then I immediately thought of you. So whatever you're doing is obviously working, because like they raved about it, just the overall experience and how great it was. And it seriously made the difference in the end of life for them.
That's great to hear. The company's been around for 10 years. I've been a part of them for 1 year, so I'd like to take all the credit, but certainly will not, because that team has been rocking and rolling right from the start, and it's a good group.
That is awesome. So yeah, you mentioned earlier about this concept of, you know, when you start doing at-home euthanasias, you get to be involved in this, like in the stories and the lives of these animals. And for me, like it'd be such emotional turmoil, you know, like, so how do you not only personally, but professionally handle kind of that emotional roller coaster of like here, kind of getting in depth and hearing these life stories and then watching, you know, a very, maybe I'm wrong though. Maybe I'm making the assumption as I'm thinking about this question, you know, cause it seems like a very sad moment, right? A grieving period, which would be very tough, but maybe in some experiences based on what you've said earlier, sometimes there's a lot of relief there too. So it's kind of a happy moment as well, but still it feels like that, you know, with all the stresses in vet med already, how do you handle that additional pressure?
You've touched on very important elements right there. And I'm glad you bring it up, because I think earlier mentioned something about that someone like yourself or others might not even get into vet med because they don't want to have those end of life conversations. They don't want to be around death. And what's really interesting is right now, for the first time ever in our history, to my knowledge, we have veterinary students that got into this field because they want to focus on end of life. They want to be animal hospice providers. They want to do home euthanasia. That has never really been talked about before. It's been the complete opposite, the nervousness of having to support dying animals, right? That might actually have been one of the deterrents to get into vet med in the first place. So very pleased to say that more and more students are graduating ready to move directly into this not necessarily a designated or approved specialty as of yet. It's just a field that's growing, but it's not a boarded specialty. But there is enough resources and training and those things, in particular through the International Association for Animal Hospice and Palliative Care. They've got a certification program for both vets and techs that they can learn quickly outside of veterinary school how to fully engross themselves in this profession and then take it from there. But so as far as how do we work within this very sensitive space? For me, the approach is what I remember Dr. Jane Shaw at Colorado State and their communication department saying many years ago, it's that helper's high. It's that knowing that we are being an angel in a very dark time, stepping in to help them, supporting them, listening to them, reserving judgment, and moving forward to release that animal from its suffering. And believe me, myself and all my colleagues who are in this space, we have seen some pretty horrific states of health for these animals that we're, you know, often going in and performing euthanasia on, which just like you said, that relief, like, whew, that's over, that animal isn't going through that anymore. But to keep myself sustained in this beyond myself thinking that I'm doing good, I really truly believe that I'm doing good in this work, is that I approach every single appointment very relaxed, and with principles in mind and not outcome, right? So I like to advocate for what's called principle-based medicine, not outcome-based medicine. So whatever that situation is, I'm going to go in and I'm going to be very kind. And again, I'm going to be patient and reserve judgment. I'm going to be compassionate, and I'm going to provide my best medicine that I can. And whatever the owner should choose from that point forward is ultimately up to them, but I'm going to at least lay out what I believe to be good medicine and the right approach. And in doing so, I'm calm and I'm relaxed. I take that time to establish rapport and the trust. And often my clients are more willing to listen. They're more willing to heed my advice, and we find that common ground. And then we're working forward in partnership. And I could do that all day long.
You know, it made me, as you talked about this idea of like principle-based medicine. And then it made me think of, so there, one of the talks that I give is, you know, how psychological safety affects your cybersecurity posture in your hospital. And one of the slides is basically, you know, I tell the story about how, you know, even though I'm somebody who thinks about this all the time, there's one moment I got compromised. And why was that? Right. And so, but when we bring on new people onto the team, I always tell them that, right? So it's like, hey, I also made a mistake. So we just need to make sure we have things in place to prevent that, right? So I'm letting them know like where I'm coming from. And it's, you know, Josh Weissman, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like part of his whole like four P's of positive psychology. And he helped me build this talk. But what it made me think of is, I'm sure you know Dr. Mary Gardner, because the vet med's yes. very small. And I had a conversation with her, and I think what really helped for me before we lost our two dogs was that she had told me about like how devastating it was for her to lose her Doberman and like how much it like wrecked her. And so like for me, somebody who's like, okay, here's basically a professional in end of life care. And but even with her own dog, she was going through the same struggles. So like when it came to my own pets, it's like, you know, even the struggles and the emotions, and sometimes I rationalize with myself, like, you should be okay with it. Like, you knew going in that, you know, and knew from 12 to maybe 20, if you can get that long, that at some point in that time frame, this is going to happen. And so you should kind of
the reality.
Yeah. And put your boots on and suck it up. But then it's like, but here's somebody who's a professional at this, and this was still hard. So it almost was like some sort of validation in my own experience, right, from a professional that I think really kind of helped me along my own journey. What is your experience with doctors who are really good at end of life care, and how they can maybe, how do they interact with clients? Like in this case, it maybe worked really well, but are there some tips or tricks for doctors out there that, you know, when it comes to this time, that they can help provide that ease from that, like that professional mindset?
Perfect. Build emotional intelligence, emotionally intelligent euthanasia, emotionally intelligent hospice, emotionally intelligent end of life care in general is vital. It's vital through all of vet med, but in particular, because we're in these very sensitive situations with a lot of intimacy, so much emotion, we need to understand what our motivators are, why we're feeling the way that we are. That's called self-awareness. How we're interacting with our client, and are we conveying what we want to convey? Are they seeing what they should be seeing from us? And then, of course, empathy. And there's another one called self-regulation. That's all part of emotional intelligence. And to Mary's point, you know, where she said she was wrecked over the loss of her Doberman, that is self-awareness, right? Just putting that in words, almost like writing it down on paper. How do I feel about this? Why do I feel this way about it? And do I want to feel this way about it? And therefore, do I need to change my emotions, right? And how am I going to change that? So just recognizing it is job number one. How do I feel right now? Am I about to walk into an appointment with a yellow lab that looks just like my yellow lab that I had euthanized 2 weeks ago or even 10 years ago? And how is that going to impact my interaction right now? And is that going to drain me? Right? Or am I going to find myself being more judgmental because the family's choosing one thing versus a way I would have done it, something like that. So my number one piece of advice, in fact, my favorite module that CADA is putting out right now is emotionally intelligent euthanasia for that very reason, because we can leverage emotional intelligence through every part of our life. But if we're going into those euthanasias without coping mechanisms and the ability to compartmentalize and truly understand why we're feeling the way that we're feeling, we are setting ourselves up for compassion fatigue. And compassion fatigue is ultimately two things. It's burnout and it's secondary traumatic stress, also known as vicarious traumatization. And you can prevent that secondary traumatic stress through physical self-regulation, which is a part of emotional intelligence. So it's all intertwined together. But my piece of advice, get familiar with emotional intelligence, figure out who you are at your core, you know, figure out what your core strengths are, what is your personality type, and that would help you to just support everyone better and have a more fulfilling career.
You talked there about this, you were talking about, you know, walking into a room and potentially having to euthanize a dog that was just like your own and then creating kind of this emotional stress. And then you touched on compassion fatigue. And interesting enough, whenever I talk to other doctors who aren't, you know, maybe they're just GP or they have a different specialty and we talk about the end of life story, a lot of times I'm like, how have you managed it? Like, how do you manage, you know, these, because, you know, I realized soon, very early on, in vet med that this is something that a lot of vets are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I oftentimes get the response, well, you know, I just know that, you know, the next appointment is probably going to be a puppy appointment, or it's another pet that I have a great relationship with. And it's almost like they try to remove themselves from the situation. And a lot of times I ask myself, like, are they maybe just lacking the proper tools to actually be present in that appointment and to deal with the stresses of that situation rather than trying to detach and just think about the next appointment?
Possible. It depends on how they handled themselves in the appointment to begin with, because those of us like me who at one point or another, I was helping 10 families a day with euthanasia. So I didn't have any puppy kitten visits afterwards. I didn't have warm and fuzzies to be reminded about, you know, youth and joy and those things. It was just kind of sadness after sadness after sadness. But I went into those appointments with that self-regulation already, relaxed and in control of my body and my thoughts, took that time to establish rapport with my clients, sharing that oxytocin back and forth, right? That love hormone, that morale molecule, and walked out of the appointment because I delivered a good euthanasia, first of all, right? I didn't allow myself to get nervous or ramped up and experiencing primary traumatic stress because of what I was incapable of doing, like to deliver a gentle death. I didn't have any of those issues. And not to say I haven't had a tough euthanasia from time to time, don't get me wrong, but the way that I've honed my skills allowed me to do this work over and over and over again. So those that aren't feeling that need a chance to escape into another type of appointment, or are find themselves, unfortunately, thinking about what just happened over and over and over again, may not be working through that appointment in the best way possible. In fact, we've coined this idea of euharmony, is what we call it, euharmony, which is you get yourself in the right headspace before you start an end-of-life appointment, euthanasia in particular, so that from beginning to end, you're very balanced. And you can actually feel better at the end of the euthanasia than when you went in, because you're embracing all of those elements, the quiet space, the time for stories, the human-animal bond, gentle death. All of that should, in essence, relax you in the course of the day. And it's actually the puppy visits that might be more intense themselves, because there's a lot of wiggling and a lot of activity. There's a lot of things to get out there to teach about, versus that, what should be a very relaxing euthanasia or a quality of life talk or something else. So if we're approaching it the right way, my hope is that veterinary staff feels better after a euthanasia appointment than when they went in. But to answer your question about what I do specifically, if I'm starting to just get a little bit frazzled in the day for whatever reason, it's usually more burnout than anything else. I've got too many demands and not enough resources. I used to listen to a lot of comedy on the road, and you know, pop on something, listen to a fun podcast or something, and just kind of break out of that space for a bit. But it was more of me just getting out of my head more than anything. But I was already very relaxed when I come out of my appointment.
You know, listening to you talk about the skills that you built, there's another veterinarian who is he's been thinking about the telemed thing for a long time, and he's based out of Portland, Oregon. I'm drawing a blank on his name, but a number of years ago at AVMA, we were having this conversation about the place of like micro specialists and the role that they'll play in medicine going forward. And it just made me think that, like, you know, what a difference a hospital could have if they had somebody that was just like an in-house end-of-life specialist. Because as I'm listening to like just this all, just the years and years of hard work and experience it has taken for you to become so good at this craft. And then it made me think about my own experience where it was like the neurologist who was doing the end of life. And then it made me have some empathy for her in a lot of regards, because I'm like, really, she's focusing her entire life on trying to better understand how to treat brain diseases and how to manage that. Like, of course, she's not going to be the best euthanasia person, right? Like, her focus is elsewhere. And so who am I to kind of put that on her? But then that led me down to this other question as you're just, you know, talking about all these unique tools that you use. And what is it like for you? Because with a lot of vets, you know, a lot of GPs, there's probably already a relationship there with the pet and the pet owner. And now as an end-of-life specialist coming in at just the very end, right? What kind of challenges do you face where, you know, you haven't had that rapport, or have all these amazing skills that you've built allowed you kind of just to slide in, make it natural and really amazing? Or what challenges would a potential vet hospital find if they're like, you know, we really should find like an end-of-life specialist that can be in the hospital on the ground floor on a day-to-day basis to kind of manage these cases? What is that like, having another doctor kind of slide in it, as opposed to, you know, the doctor that the family's worked with for the last 15 years.
Yeah, I like this direction. And, you know, can we start to leverage these subspecialties more, such as end-of-life providers that are in the community already shining, doing amazing good work? I think it starts with the GPs asking themselves, what do they want to do? You know, do they want to be everything to everyone? And right now, and especially after the pandemic, I think we feel like that might not be sustainable, right? Maybe we should be utilizing more of the experts that are out there to offset that load. And so more than ever, there are home services available in so many parts of the country and now the world that a GP can say to the owner, well, here's what we can provide for you. And here else are the resources in our community, and here's what they can provide for you. Would you like me to facilitate an introduction? Is this something you would want? And even with that pre-planning part of it, with regards to euthanasia, where do you want to be? You know, do you want to come into the hospital for the procedure or do you want to be in the home? And if the answer is the home, then it might be automatically that we're going to go ahead and bring in those mobile services to participate. So the other thing is something that I've been looking at with Caring Pathways and some of the others that I consult with is there a way for independent contractors to work within the hospitals a little bit more? So in to say that the veterinarians at the hospital who aren't necessarily experts in euthanasia or just don't have the time to devote those resources for an hour-long appointment or a 90-minute appointment, or sometimes how long these euthanasias can be, can they start to actually bring in independent contractors into the hospital to do that work for them? So that's a win-win. And we're always looking for that. We always want to make sure what's the best for the client, for the patient, for the veterinary team, for those experts that are in the community just ready to help, you know, standing by all the time. So there's different approaches, but the takeaway is for anybody to ask themselves, am I doing this the best I possibly can do it? And if somebody can do it better, then what should I be leveraging here? What can I do for my client and provide for them that better experience? A lot of opportunity there, Clint.
Yeah. I mean, and I think you at the very beginning, you said, you know, we can't be everything to everyone, which is 100% right. Right. And we've learned that, you know, I guess I've learned that. And luckily I have the amazing support of Logan on my team to help us as a company realize too, because a lot of times we'll get customers that want us to be things that we're really not, right? And sometimes it's hard to say no, but then it's like, but it's for the better, you know, for us to say no, like that's not really what we specialize in. And you'd probably be better served by this other company. And then it also makes me think about, I mean, if you go on like LinkedIn right now and you just look at the veterinary community, it's like every hospital, every practice manager that maybe you're connected with are hiring an associate. And so it comes back to this idea of like being insanely short staffed, you know, and then you mentioned that like 90-minute appointment, right? And especially if an associate's on like some sort of pro salary, you know, commission, they're like, oh, I hate euthanasias. It's rough. You know, I'm just throwing a scenario out there and it's going to take forever. And I've got all these appointments stacked up. I just think about the extra stress that kind of the current state of staffing in veterinary medicine, the extra pressures they kind of put on end of life care.
You're absolutely right. And there is an opportunity to increase what we're putting out there for our services if we want to do everything, right? GPs can do oncology work and they can do some of those specialized surgeries and they can do advanced end-of-life care. So through groups like the International Association for Animal Hospice and CADA, which again stands for the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy, we can teach those skills that can be harnessed and utilized in GP all day long. But if they decide that they don't have the time and resources for it and they want their clients to have a better experience, they want their patients to have a better experience, that's where they can start to find out who's available in the community to support them. And this is probably a good opportunity to bring up aftercare and the fact that we as an industry feel like we have to be the funeral home for all of our patients, and we don't need to do that in much of this country. There are fabulous aftercare facilities, teams that are standing by to handle everything. It's just been a paradigm for our profession for decades. And it's time for us to start to look at and just pull in those relationships with the aftercare companies, find out what they can do for us. They can be such a thing that the aftercare company handles everything from finances to the type of cremation that they want, to the type of urns that they want, to the memorialization where ashes are actually picked up at the crematory and not back at the hospital, which takes an amazing amount of time, right? And a lot of the hospitals aren't pricing appropriately for everything that they do for aftercare, or potentially are even pricing too high. And now the clients can't afford what they want. So I encourage listeners to find more ways to help their clients with aftercare needs, including pet loss resources, pet loss support groups, and everything that's out there. There's more there than I think most of us realize.
So on more of a positive note, I feel like I've been like the playing devil's advocate here, you know, but I think of all these questions and these challenges we're facing. But I think on a positive note, and I'd love for you to talk about your experience about this, is it seems like I've talked with a lot of doctors who was like, yeah, euthanasia in the, you know, back in the day was like bring the animal in, throw them on the tech station counter, slam it in, done, it's over with, right? Where now it has become a lot more thoughtful, emotionally intelligent process. What have you seen in your time being involved in vet med from this kind of just like, I don't know, very compassionless, it seems, end of life care, where it's just, yep, you know, putting the dog down, moving on, to now a lot more thoughtful process, even now where you're able to offer like a hospice service for animals?
So what we like to call it is the good death revolution. And the good death revolution is heavily tied to euthanasia and making sure that we're approaching the procedure and the experience with all of those right elements, with those, what Cata refers to as our 14 essential components. But the good death revolution also could include hospice, right? And making sure that we are having that conversation about the disease and the disease trajectory and providing that palliative medicine to reduce suffering and increasing comfort, right? All the way through death, whether or not that is through euthanasia or through natural death. What I've seen in the past 10 years in particular is more and more attention paid to euthanasia in particular, wherein more and more clients are able to be with their pet all the way through the procedure. That is the number one thing that pet owners want. We just did a survey with almost 2,000 pet owners and asked them to define a good death. And Clint, that one came out at number one. They don't want to be separated from their pet. So those hospitals that are resisting bringing the pet back to the treatment area and instead are keeping the pet in the euthanasia room with their owners from beginning to end, that's what the owners are looking for. That's the good death revolution, where now we can provide that pre-euthanasia sedation or anesthesia to help the animal be deep in sleep before any technical things are done, including catheter placement. It is still, I'm not sure what the percentage is right now, but it's still fairly common for animals to be brought back to the treatment area, catheter placed, brought back into the room with the owner, and then given propofol, an anesthetic to induce sleep, then followed immediately by the euthanasia solution. What Cata advocates for, and so many others out there too, let's not do that. Let's go ahead and just provide that sedation or anesthesia underneath the skin or into the muscle. Let's allow that deep sleep, and then we start doing those technical aspects. And doing so in a way that is comfortable for the pet all the way through. So that injection is pain-free, there's no resistance, definitely following the fear-free mindset and protocols. So those two things in particular have been game changers. And there's a lot of hospitals that are doing it. The mobile services are doing it no matter what, because when they're in the home environment, the family is there. They're often in the master bedroom, or they're out in the backyard or in front of the fireplace. Everybody's gathered around. So all technical aspects are witnessed. And that's the norm. So I think if we can take those beautiful elements from home euthanasia, bring that as much into the hospital as we can, that's a win-win, except for those hospitals that might not have the time resources to allow a, you know, comfort room or exam room to be, you know, utilized for an entire hour or an hour and a half or something like that. That's where we get to be a little bit more creative in the way that we leverage our staff to be going in and out and supporting the family, but still keep a functional operational hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was amazing because like, as you were like, well, most hospitals, and then as you're saying, I was like, yep, happened to us, you know, took our dog back, put the catheter in, and then it was, you know, same kind of deal. And then, I mean, the same way with the second dog we lost too, but he was already at the hospital. So he kind of came in the room with the catheter already in, which makes sense. But I didn't even know that the under the skin piece was even an option. Like, I don't know that, you know, just like the sedation under the skin was even an option. So that was pretty eye-opening for me as well. Well, it has been amazing talking to you. And as I said, I have two canned questions. And then the other one I have the other canned question that I have at the end is, you know, it's pretty much shameless self-promotion. Is there anything you want anybody to know about? Where can they find out more about you? Any services you offer? It's pretty much your time to kind of shine. Well, you've already shown, but it's kind of your time to, yeah, same shameless self-promotion, anything you want to promote or just make sure people are aware of.
Thank you. If you talk to my staff long enough, they'll be able to tell you that I am horrible at self-promotion.
Me too.
I do like to just talk about the important components of all these, you know, procedures, euthanasia, hospice, aftercare, and everything. So thanks for the opportunity. I am, as I said, Director of Education for the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy, also known as CADA. So we have a wealth of resources for anyone who's listening, including more information about our EuHarmony program, where we actually go into the hospitals and teach the team. We work within their culture to elevate their euthanasia delivery of services. I am, as I mentioned, Chief Medical Officer of Caring Pathways, which is a home hospice and euthanasia service in Colorado and Virginia. And so you can reach me through that organization. And then I am affiliate faculty at Colorado State University, so you can reach me there. And if there's anyone who's listening that is interested in writing articles together and doing research together so that we can continue to elevate end-of-life support for our patients and clients and the veterinary teams who deliver this care, I am all in.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. I got to see you briefly in person in Vegas, so it was great to see you, and hopefully I'll run into you again soon.
Thanks, Clint.
Thank you.